I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jerry Sabloff. He is president of the Santa Fe Institute. Tonight and tomorrow, he will be delivering the Stanislav Ulam Lectures. Tonight at 7:30, it's How Insights from Archaeology Might Help Shape Our Future, and tomorrow, Maya Archaeology and Its Relevance to the Modern World. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
Let's talk for a moment about what exactly the work of the archaeologist is. I mean, we think of you guys out there in the hot sun digging in the dirt, but the field has evolved quite a bit.
Right. As I'm going to try to indicate tonight, archaeology is both more complicated and more interesting than I think often the general public grasps. But I'll note, you know, that probably the most famous archaeologists, or at least pseudo-archaeologists, are Indiana Jones and Lara Croft, who, you know, we see and hear a lot about. But archaeology is not about trying to discover objects, although that's certainly a part of it. But that's a means, not an end. What archaeologists really want to do is try to understand peoples and cultures of the past, how and why they changed. But to do so is a very complex and interesting process. Part of it, as I'll indicate, is rather mundane and boring. You're out in the field and you may be, you know, with a trowel under the difficult temperature, environmental conditions, scraping carefully away for hours at end, trying to reveal stratigraphic layers, pieces of stone or bone or ceramic, clay objects, and so on. And then later on, going over carefully all these finds in the laboratory, you know, from the field. When I did my doctoral dissertation years ago at Harvard, I ended up analyzing, or at least looking at, you know, something on the order of 250,000 potsherds from a site in Guatemala that we'd been working at. Now, I'm not going to say that there are parts of that are fascinating, but also it's very routinized and can be very boring. It's not me with a machete in my hand being chased by native peoples whose sacred objects I've stolen. That's, you know,
right.
That's nice in the movies, but not in reality. So archaeologists today have an incredible arsenal of techniques and methods they can use to study the archaeological record that we see today and try to understand the activities in the past that produced the record that we see today, because obviously much is lost, you know, perishable objects and so on. But it's incredible through chemistry, biology, physics. There are a host of techniques that we can use that illuminate the past in ways that even 10 or 15 years ago were impossible. And I'm going to talk about how, you know, this whole arsenal of tools that we can now use in various ways have relevance and applicability to the world today. That's on one hand. On the other, I'm also going to talk about our findings, you know, our interpretations, how those can have relevance. So it's really both sides of the coin, the technical methodological, which has gone through incredible advances in recent years, and the understandings, what our interpretations tell us, which are much richer because of all our techniques than they were in the past, and how both of these can help us not only illuminate the present, but hopefully at least give us some context for the future. What I'll argue both tonight and tomorrow night, you know, more generally tonight, although I'll give a host of short examples, and then tomorrow night where I'll use ancient Maya civilization as a more extended case study, is that archaeologists aren't going to solve the problems facing the world today. That would be sheer hubris to say that. But I think often we can provide useful context. I'm a firm believer in lessons from the past. And I think we can find ways to utilize archaeological, say, techniques and knowledge to help us in our decision making that affect us today and obviously affect us in the future. I mean, your listeners are well aware of the array of really, some of them seemingly impossible problems facing the world today and the need for solutions. And to say those solutions won't come from archaeology, I wish they could, but I think helping us find good solutions can come from archaeology, and it's an area that I feel passionately about. Is when I first was on your program, when I came back to New Mexico 5 years ago, we talked about my book that I'd just written called Archaeology Matters. And if anything, the last half dozen years since that time that book was published has given us much more, stronger arguments than ever before for the case that I was making in that book. And that's what I would like to share with the audiences tonight and tomorrow.
Well, that's something that I wanted to ask you. I mean, this very provocative title, How Insights from Archaeology Might Help Shape Our Future. How has past archaeology shaped our present?
Okay, that's a fair question. And I think the answer is not so much, for two reasons. One is, as I was just saying earlier, I think we have just a lot better information and control of our empirical data than we have in the past, and it's much richer. And so I think we can do more than in the past. And also, I think the attitudes of archaeologists are changing, where before, and I'll talk a little bit about this tonight, the major questions facing archaeologists as we were trying to build up at least a framework for understanding the world of the past was basically on more in chronology and placing objects and materials and cultures in time and space.
Right.
Now that that framework is there with greater precision than it ever has been, archaeologists, I think, can move on. So the attitudes have changed. I think in the past, and there are exceptions, but by and large, archaeologists didn't see what they were doing as right. They were illuminating the past, and that was of interest, but it was not often related to the present-day world.
This question of past civilizations or societies, for example, facing crises, and maybe some of those crises are analogous to ones that we're facing now. What are some examples of that?
Okay, so tomorrow night, when we look at ancient Maya civilization, I'm going to be looking at the whole question of long-term sustainability and resilience. How did the Maya, over 2,500 years up to the Spanish conquest, how did their civilization develop and grow? How were they able to sustain it? What were some of the ups and downs? There's a period where a certain number of the cities in the southern part of the Yucatan Peninsula declined, and there's a demographic shift to north. Popularly, this used to be called the classic Maya collapse. We now know it's more complicated than that, but clearly there are major changes, and they were affected by drought. Now, they'd faced droughts before. How were they successful in some times and not successful in others? Changing economic times, degradation of the land, growth of population. I mean, these are all themes that we, are very much current in our world today. And I think what I'll argue is relevant is the decision-making process that the elite rulers, the kings and queens of the major Maya city-states, how they coped with what almost might be a perfect storm of a series of crises, and how are they successful in sustaining, and where and why did they fail? So I think it's not the specifics that are as important as the decision-making process, and I think that can, help illuminate problems, although the degree and kind have changed today. Anyone who lives in New Mexico knows that drought and water are key questions, and they were just as much so in a tropical rainforest environment as they are in our desert environment
here
in New Mexico. Yeah. No, I mean, the idea that water, in a place that may get over 100 inches of rainfall, a year is a problem, but it is. For example, much of the Yucatan Peninsula is basically a limestone shelf, and when it rains, unless you have good water capture, that rainwater drains right through the surface into the underwater aquifer. So here you are basically in a jungle, but you have to worry about water collection. You have to build reservoirs. You have to build cisterns. You have to have various ways of capturing the water because you get this incredibly strong rainy season, but then you get a dry season. And if you haven't captured the water, and if you don't have metal tools or techniques to drill perhaps well over 100 feet or more to the water table, you're dependent on surface water. Now, if you live near a river, that's one thing, but if you don't, that's another. And so then the whole question of the agricultural techniques you use, do you cut down rainforest? What effect does that have on soil? What does increasing population have? All those. What is warfare and conflict? These are issues. I mean, obviously the scale is very different today, but they're still essential problems for sustainability that we need to cope with today.
including also leadership and inequality and issues of that kind as well.
Right. There are other arguments. Some of your listeners may be familiar with Jared Diamond's book on collapse, and I'll indicate tomorrow night where, although I think we probably agree on the basic facts, we would disagree on interpretation and what the leadership did and how it perceived the problems and what steps that it took or not took. So I think that's the kind of nuance. It's not what specific decisions that, you know, the Maya took are going to help us today, but the whole process and how they perceived problems and what kind of steps. And I'll argue, in fact, in hindsight, some of the steps that they took actually exacerbated their problems rather than solve them. And again, it's not the specifics that are as important, but the general problem. So that's just one example. I said that'll be a major focus tomorrow night. But tonight I'm going to more just show the kinds of ways that archaeology can be relevant today. I mean, there are obvious ones. Archaeology is clearly related to economic development. Tourism in many parts of the world, in large part in certain places, is dependent on archaeological resources, how they're conserved, how they're interpreted, how they're used. How is tourism and conservation, how can you make them compatible? But they're also related to a host of issues. And some of them as simple as filling gaps in recent history. We might say to ourselves, we have history books. This may be, kind of early 20th century, 19th century. One example I'll use, just think about it, is Pony Express. Show my age from, kind of watching TV westerns and the movies. We have all that picture of Pony Express rider jumping up, taking saddlebags, getting a new horse and so on. Lots of information. But in fact, if you go to the history books, what did the Pony Express station look like? How did the fellow who was in that station, what did they eat? How did they live? It's that kind of mundane detail that's missing. But in more kind of serious ways, look at slavery in the 18th and 19th centuries. We know a lot about the practice of slavery, and we may know a lot about what happened in the plantation house. But specifics of what did the field slaves eat? Were there differences between, say, the diets of house slaves versus field slaves, what kind of utensils they have and so on. A lot of that specific information, even though it's not that far in the past, is not readily available in written history. And it's archaeologists who can help fill those gaps in some ways that are illuminating and of great interest and relevance to the world. And I could go on. I mean, I'll offer, those are just two of half a dozen or more examples that I'll mention. And one can go on in the 20th century. Also, at the same time, one has to worry. I mean, archaeology has been used in dangerous ways. One only has to look back at how the Nazis justified the superiority, supposedly, of the Aryan race and relied on really poor and misinterpretation of archaeology, but in a sense they used archaeology. And we see that in ethnic conflicts today where archaeology may be used by one side or another to justify various kinds of actions. So archaeologists also need to be aware that their findings can be used for good and often can, or may just be of relevance to other archaeologists or social scientists. But we have to be careful of how we state them and publish them, because others may use them for their own ends and twist them in ways that we would find reprehensible.
As an archaeologist, well, to the public, people think of pyramids and monuments, but a lot of what you do is also the archaeology of ordinary people who lived some time ago.
Right.
And I often wonder, I mean, people talk about great civilizations as the ones that have great monuments, but I sometimes wonder whether the great civilization isn't the one where people have more equality, or they ate better, or they all participated. I mean, these are...
No, that's a wonderful point. I mean, and it's that's a whole area of interest that much of my career in archaeology, before I became a museum director and then president here at the Institute, was devoted to in many ways, in today's parlance. And I got this from my mentor at Harvard, late Gordon Willey, who was one of the pioneers in what was called settlement archaeology, where he was interested in what we call today the 99%, whereas much of archaeology, particularly in areas of the great ancient civilizations, the Maya, central Mexico, the Andes, Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, China, for much of the history of archaeology, were interested in the great monuments, in the architecture, in the high art, and for a variety of intellectual and cultural reasons. Much of archaeology until kind of post-World War II was financed either by museums or by wealthy donors. And they were interested in bringing back, you know, the great discovering the Royal Cemetery at Ur or King Tut's tomb and so on. And as I'll point out, and I think I've written about it and pointed out before in lecture, what this was, looking back, is a sampling error. We were looking, in effect, at the 1% and saying from that we could know what the 100% was. And that just, you know, wasn't the case. And so since World War II, we now have a much richer and fuller picture. And that's why I'm saying archaeology, I think, is more relevant today, because we're getting a fuller picture of peoples at all different levels of complexity in the past and how they developed and changed, and looking at best we can, at least samples of a whole society rather than just the ones that were producing the great monuments. Give you an example I won't be talking about, but it's a nice one related to some of my colleagues' earlier research. The period of Maya history just before the Spanish conquest in the past was often called the decadent period, because the Maya weren't building, you know, the great temples and palaces. Their rulers lived what we seemingly more modestly. So a lot of the trappings of classic Maya civilization were gone. But in fact, if you look at both the political and especially the economic picture at those times, one might argue that, in fact, the standard of living of many peoples was going up. They had more access to goods and so on. They didn't think, if we were at a time machine, yes, that the world was decadent at all. In fact, it's not civilization going downhill, but for them, civilization was actually stronger. Their lives, or at least many of them, were better. And as one of my colleagues used to say, even the elite and the rulers weren't building for archaeologists. They were building for their time, and a lot of that may have, to us, appear cheap or sloppy. When I used to tell students, you know, in talking about that, so think of all the architects or, you know, complaining about the architecture of a Motel 6, you know, or a Holiday Inn, or you know, what have you. It's not the Broadmoor, you know, or Waldorf or Astoria or someone. But for someone who was able to travel, you know, across the country and stay in places, like, this is not decadence. It's so a lot of it, I once wrote a paper entitled, "It Depends on How You Look at Things." Yeah. It really, the perspective is very important. And I think the main interest today and relevance to what you and I are talking about is that archaeologists are trying to have many perspectives rather than, say, just one that focuses on the big monuments or the high art.
I do find myself wondering, I mean, let's say there are some very deep insights about process that archaeology can teach us that might help us and help our leaders to go through, for example, climate change and environmental crises and things like that. You think Congress is going to listen?
Well, that's a good question. One can argue that they don't seem to be listening to anything right now.
But I mean,
do
leaders listen to insights from history, I guess, is the bigger question.
So I think the answer is some do. And all one can hope for is that we can get enlightened leadership on both sides of the aisle who are willing to listen to ideas that might help their constituents today. And there's certainly, we do have people in Congress and certainly in the federal government who are interested in, and we have them more locally as well. I mean, I think there's been in recent years much more enlightened view about the importance of archaeological remains and their relevance here in Santa Fe and in New Mexico, you know, in general, growing interest of pueblos and tribal groups in not only understanding their past, but having their own people explore the past, with a variety of, you know, indigenous archaeological, groups who either do the work or help supervise others. So I think I'm at least guardedly optimistic, Mary Charlotte, about your question. But in reality, in terms of kind of the general mood, certainly in Washington, I'm not holding my breath.
Jerry Sabloff is president of the Santa Fe Institute. He will be delivering the Stanislav Ulam lectures tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf here in Santa Fe. For more information, the Santa Fe Institute is at santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. This has been fun.